ambassador to England of faith. You may like to gamble, you might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll.
You gotta serve somebody. That's a long time lesson from Bob Dylan. You gotta serve somebody. You're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Thursday, September the 27th, 2012. And today we are going to do some serious talking and deconstructing. We are going to listen for what is not said. What is not said. Of course, a lot is made of the various speeches delivered at the 67th session of the General Assembly at the United Nations. And the President's speech was certainly in focus. We're going to hear a pretty sizable chunk of that speech, which ran a little bit more than 30 minutes, just a tad more, but we'll listen to at least half of it. Because in the half that we're listening to, he constructs the message that we ought to get. And what the exercise is today is to listen very astutely and deconstruct what is said, paying specific attention to what is not said. I used to call it, when I did these exercises using the print media, I'd call it reading between the lies. But here we have to listen for what is not said. And it's very, very important.
On behalf of the General Assembly, I have the honor to welcome to the United Nations His Excellency Barack Obama, President of the United States of America, and to invite him to address the Assembly.
Mr. President, Mr. Secretary General, fellow delegates, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to begin today by telling you about an American named Chris Stevens. Now, Chris was born in a town called Grass Valley, California, the son of a lawyer and a musician. As a young man, Chris joined the Peace Corps and taught English in Morocco. And he came to love and respect the people of North Africa and the Middle East. He would carry that commitment throughout his life. As a diplomat, he worked from Egypt to Syria, from Saudi Arabia to Libya. He was known for walking the streets of the cities where he worked, tasting the local food, meeting as many people as he could, speaking Arabic, listening with a broad smile. Chris went to Benghazi in the early days of the Libyan Revolution, arriving on a cargo ship. As America's representative, he helped the Libyan people as they coped with violent conflict, cared for the wounded, and crafted a vision for the future in which the rights of all Libyans would be respected. And after the revolution, he supported the birth of a new democracy as Libyans held elections and built new institutions and began to move forward after decades of dictatorship. Chris Stevens loved his work. He took pride in the country he served, and he saw dignity in the people that he met. And 2 weeks ago, he traveled to Benghazi to review plans to establish a new cultural center and modernize a hospital. That's when America's compound came under attack. Along with three of his colleagues, Chris was killed in the city that he helped to save. He was 52 years old. I tell you this story because Chris Stevens embodied the best of America. Like his fellow Foreign Service officers, he built bridges across oceans and cultures and was deeply invested in the international cooperation that the United Nations represents. He acted with humility, but he also stood up for a set of principles, a belief that individuals should be free to determine their own destiny and live with liberty, dignity, justice, and opportunity. The attacks on the civilians in Benghazi were attacks on America. We are grateful for the assistance we received from the Libyan government and from the Libyan people. There should be no doubt that we will be relentless in tracking down the killers and bringing them to justice. And I also appreciate that in recent days, the leaders of other countries in the region, including Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen, have taken steps to secure our diplomatic facilities and called for calm. And so have religious authorities around the globe. But understand, the attacks of the last 2 weeks are not simply an assault on America. They are also an assault on the very ideals upon which the United Nations was founded. The notion that people can resolve their differences peacefully, that diplomacy can take the place of war, that in an interdependent world, all of us have a stake in working towards greater opportunity and security for our citizens. If we are serious about upholding these ideals, it will not be enough to put more guards in front of an embassy or to put out statements of regret and wait for the outrage to pass. If we are serious about these ideals, we must speak honestly about the deeper causes of the crisis, because we face a choice between the forces that would drive us apart and the hopes that we hold in common. Today, we must reaffirm that our future will be determined by people like Chris Stevens and not by his killers. Today, we must declare that this violence and intolerance has no place among our United Nations. It's been less than 2 years since a vendor in Tunisia set himself on fire to protest the oppressive corruption in his country and sparked what became known as the Arab Spring. And since then, the world has been captivated by the transformation that's taken place. And the United States has supported the forces of change. We were inspired by the Tunisian protests that toppled a dictator, because we recognized our own beliefs in the aspiration of men and women who took to the streets. We insisted on change in Egypt because our support for democracy ultimately put us on the side of the people. We supported a transition of leadership in Yemen because the interests of the people were no longer being served by a corrupt status quo. We intervened in Libya alongside a broad coalition and with the mandate of the United Nations Security Council because we had the ability to stop the slaughter of innocents and because we believed that the aspirations of the people were more powerful than a tyrant. And as we meet here, we again declare that the regime of Bashar al-Assad must come to an end so that the suffering of the Syrian people can stop and a new dawn can begin. We have taken these positions because we believe that freedom and self-determination are not unique to one culture. These are not simply American values or Western values. They are universal values. And even as there will be huge challenges to come with a transition to democracy, I am convinced that ultimately government of the people, by the people, and for the people is more likely to bring about the stability, prosperity, and individual opportunity that serve as a basis for peace in our world. So let us remember that this is a season of progress. For the first time in decades, Tunisians, Egyptians, and Libyans voted for new leaders in elections that were credible, competitive, and fair. And this democratic spirit has not been restricted to the Arab world. Over the past year, we've seen peaceful transitions of power in Malawi and Senegal, and a new president in Somalia. In Burma, a president has freed political prisoners and opened a closed society. A courageous dissident has been elected to parliament, and people look forward to further reform. Around the globe, people are making their voices heard, insisting on their innate dignity and the right to determine their future. And yet the turmoil of recent weeks reminds us that the path to democracy does not end with the casting of a ballot. Nelson Mandela once said, "To be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others." True democracy demands that citizens cannot be thrown in jail because of what they believe, and that businesses can be opened without paying a bribe. It depends on the freedom of citizens to speak their minds and assemble without fear, and on the rule of law and due process that guarantees the rights of all people. In other words, true democracy, real freedom, is hard work. Those in power have to resist the temptation to crack down on dissidents. In hard economic times, countries must be tempted, to rally the people around perceived enemies at home and abroad, rather than focusing on the painstaking work of reform. Moreover, there will always be those that reject human progress, dictators who cling to power, corrupt interests that depend on the status quo, and extremists who fan the flames of hate and division. From Northern Ireland to South Asia, from Africa to the Americas, from the Balkans to the Pacific Rim, we've witnessed convulsions that can accompany transitions to a new political order. At times, the conflicts arise along the fault lines of race or tribe. And often they arise from the difficulties of reconciling tradition and faith with the diversity and interdependence of the modern world. In every country, there are those who find different religious beliefs threatening. In every culture, those who love freedom for themselves must ask themselves how much they're willing to tolerate freedom for others. And that is what we saw play out in the last 2 weeks, as a crude and disgusting video sparked outrage throughout the Muslim world. Now, I have made it clear that the United States government had nothing to do with this video, and I believe its message must be rejected by all who respect our common humanity. It is an insult not only to Muslims, but to America as well. For as the city outside these walls makes clear, we are a country that has welcomed people of every race and every faith. We are home to Muslims who worship across our country. We not only respect the freedom of religion, we have laws that protect individuals from being harmed because of how they look or what they believe. We understand why people take offense to this video, because millions of our citizens are among them. I know there are some who ask, why don't we just ban such a video? And the answer is enshrined in our laws. Our Constitution protects the right to practice free speech. Here in the United States, countless publications provoke offense. Like me, the majority of Americans are Christian, and yet we do not ban blasphemy against our most sacred beliefs. As president of our country and commander-in-chief of our military, I accept that people are going to call me awful things every day. And I will always defend their right to do so. Americans have fought and died around the globe to protect the right of all people to express their views, even views that we profoundly disagree with. We do not do so because we support hateful speech. but because our founders understood that without such protections, the capacity of each individual to express their own views and practice their own faith may be threatened. We do so because in a diverse society, efforts to restrict speech can quickly become a tool to silence critics and oppress minorities. We do so because, given the power of faith in our lives and the passion that religious differences can inflame, the strongest weapon against hateful speech is not repression. It is more speech. The voices of tolerance that rally against bigotry and blasphemy and lift up the values of understanding and mutual respect. Now, I know that not all countries in this body share this particular understanding of the protection of free speech. We recognize that. But in 2012, at a time when anyone with a cell phone can spread offensive views around the world with a click of a button, the notion that we can control the flow of information is obsolete. And the question then is, how do we respond? And on this, we must agree. There is no speech that justifies mindless violence. There are no words that excuse the killing of innocents. There's no video that justifies an attack on an embassy. There's no slander that provides an excuse for people to burn a restaurant in Lebanon or destroy a school in Tunis or cause death and destruction in Pakistan. In this modern world, with modern technologies, for us to respond in that way to hateful speech empowers any individual who engages in such speech to create chaos around the world. We empower the worst of us if that's how we respond. More broadly, the events of the last 2 weeks also speak to the need for all of us to honestly address the tensions between the West and the Arab world that is moving towards democracy. Now, let me be clear. Just as we cannot solve every problem in the world, the United States has not and will not seek to dictate the outcome of democratic transitions abroad. We do not expect other nations to agree with us on every issue. Nor do we assume that the violence of the past weeks or the hateful speech by some individuals represent the views of the overwhelming majority of Muslims, any more than the views of the people who produced this video represents those of Americans. However, I do believe that it is the obligation of all leaders in all countries to speak out forcefully against violence and extremism.
All right. You should have come up with some pretty interesting analyses by now of what you have heard. And we are going to deconstruct this, keeping in mind this is the 67th session of the UN General Assembly. Our president has spoken for, up until this point, half of his speech has been delivered up until this point. Your observations, and put yourself in the role of a historian, let's say. You're in a historic moment. How are we to read this moment based on this speech? That's your task at 1-888-874-4888. I'm going to push you. I'm going to probe you. So be prepared. 1-888-874-4888. Our task today in this open forum is to deconstruct this speech. And what should we come away with that you haven't heard on CNN or Fox News or any place else that you have listened to the speech on? What is the significance? And there are many component parts. How do we interpret a speech? The idea is all speeches, and this one is no exception, it's about selling an idea of some sort. How do you deconstruct the speech? What are we to take away from it? Your comments, your insightful analysis, right after this break at 1-888-874-4888. Gonna have to serve somebody. It may be a state trooper, it may be a young Turk, maybe the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. All right. Thank you, Bob Dylan. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. All right. We've just heard a speech, and you are the deconstructors of this speech. You're going to tell us what is happening, what just happened here, and what are we to make of the speech. You are the historian of the moment. Translate the moment to us. We have David from New Rochelle. David, you're on the air.
Hi there. Hello. I'm a great fan of yours years and years ago.
Oh,
we met,
you.
And you know I'm a fan of you in WBAI. Anyway, these presidents, the last couple, are just geniuses as far as their propaganda.
Tell us specifically about the speech. What's the most significant thing?
He would say something was really wonderful, some program, the next day he'd cancel it over and over again. This guy, Obama, to quote somebody else, every word was a lie, including and the.
You're going broad here, David. I want you to get real narrow. Tell me something specific that you as a historian can counter, or tell me how this speech is to be interpreted based on what we've heard so far.
You cannot bomb restaurants and wherever the heck it is. Meanwhile, we have these, everything he says you can't do, in fact, he's doing the exact opposite. Point after point after point. It's just amazing. The guy is as good as Goebbels, or better.
Tell us specifically what you have observed. Specifically, you're speaking generally now. I want you to be real specific.
Well, I remember the bombing thing, and then free speech. He locks you up in an insane asylum if you talk about 9/11. I mean, every single specific thing is the opposite. That's all I can say. It's
all right.
Amazing.
Thank you, David. Thanks
it's
so
genius.
Much.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. Ed from Los Angeles, you are our historian. Deconstruct the moment for us.
Well, I believe that this speech, if we're going to take it on face value, is a setup for military invention in all of these Middle Eastern countries. And, of course, we know this is hypocritical because we have been involved in all of these Middle East. Our CIA has been involved in propagating these riots in Libya and in Syria and in all these Middle Eastern countries. And it's just an excuse and a setup for us to militarily intervene in all these countries. And we all know that this is hypocritical because we've been involved in the Middle East since 1953 when our CIA helped to overthrow Mossadegh in Iran, setting up the repressive Shah, who was basically overthrown by the Ayatollah in 1979. And also, when he talks about the, I noticed he talked about everybody in America has the right to express free speech. That's not true. On New Year's Eve, he signed the National Authorization Defense Bill. Basically, he can arrest anyone at will and call anyone a terrorist, which is constitutionally illegal. So the speech is loaded with hypocrisies that I have noticed, and it's basically a setup. And it's not freedom, because most of these countries that we have put puppet people in are dictators, and they're repressive. So this speech is an excuse for us to not only invade Iran, but to control the entire Middle East. And that's our goal, and that was the goal of the New World Order, that book that was written by Paul Wolfowitz, and I forget the other author's name. And Obama is a puppet and pawn of this new regime to basically control all of the Middle East.
Okay, but Ed, let's talk about this specific moment. I understand your point of view. What is the purpose of the General Assembly meeting, the opening of the assembly? What do you expect to happen there?
I believe it's an overview of our foreign policies to outline to these countries to get their okay to support our intervention in all these countries, and to basically tell them that we're there to basically spell out to them that we want to spread freedom around the world to these different countries, such
okay.
as Libya.
And now
Syria.
Halfway into the speech, because it lasted about 30 minutes, halfway into the speech, did you get a sense that this mission, this particular task, was fulfilled?
I believe that... As far as the people, I can't speak for the people there.
Not talking
yes,
about the president.
I do believe that
as the president, as the spokesperson for the United States, speaking at a world convention of nations, and as you correctly said, it's normally expected that you would lay out some kind of a plan. Did you hear a plan yet?
I heard a precipice for a plan, not a specific plan, but I heard a foundation for a plan. A foundation, meaning we have these gentlemen that were trying to restore freedom in Libya that were killed, and I believe it was a foundation for a plan. Not a specific plan yet, but a foundation for a plan. That's what I got from the speech.
Why did we hear so much, and not that it is... not a deep wound to the nation, but why did we hear so much? Why did the president spend so much time on an obituary?
Because I think he wanted to arouse the emotions of those that he wanted on board for military intervention into these countries. So what he wanted to do was arouse emotions by explaining that this good-natured person was killed for his efforts to bring about freedom and democracy in Libya. And so that's basically the purpose of the speech, was to lay down the foundation that all of these nations should be outraged and should be on board and support the United States military intervention. But we are already... it's almost a moot point, because we already are involved in all of these countries militarily, including Iran. So this is basically, he's trying to get approval for what we are already doing in these countries by laying out this foundation and arousing these emotions by these countries.
All right. I think you hit the nail on the head, and I think you pointed us in a perfect direction. And thank you very much, Ed.
Thank you for returning to radio.
Great.
You are absolutely wonderful. I enjoy your program so much.
Oh, thank you so much. All right. That is a huge observation. Speaking at the United Nations General Assembly, all world leaders have the attention of the world and, of course, the President of the United States, more so than many other presidents and heads of state. I mean, there are quite a number of people we haven't heard from and we won't hear from, because somehow the media thinks what they have to say is really not significant. This is an election year. Barack Obama is on the ropes from the opposition, saying that he's soft on the Arab world and that he's an apologist for the United States. He situates himself in the speech as a person who is not soft, but reasonable. He does not come across with a hard line approach. He has an iron fist in a very soft glove. And that's he's approachable. So it's on record that he has addressed the situation. At this meeting, where it is expected that heads of state would outline the objectives of their respective countries with regard to the rest of the world and their relationship to it, we have heard 15 minutes, half of a speech, essentially starting out with an obituary, a panegyric to the Libyan ambassador and three other diplomatic workers who were killed in an attack on the U.S. embassy in Libya. It therefore rings with his critics that he has not forgotten this. This is very important to him. And in making a speech, symbolism is very, very important. So he stands on literally the tragedy in Libya to now make a point. It's done very subtly, but Ed was right on the money. Done very subtly, and it sounds very rational. And you could understand this is a man with great sympathy, a man with great ethos, a man with great compassion, a man deeply disturbed. So we start out with the obituary. And through this example, the president illustrates what America's commitment has been. And through Chris Stevens, the ambassador, America's sacrifices for democracy, freedom, and democracy in the region. And we know, as Ed said, there will be a payback coming. Somebody is going to have to serve somebody. And what exactly that would be will unfold in due course. But he has sent the signal that there is going to be a payback. And the payback is not vengeance. The payback is in achieving strategic objectives in that region, and the governments of that region will have to fall in line with U.S. and allied objectives in the region, because this is yet another example, and perhaps after 9/11, the most blatant example of U.S. sacrifice for the sake and cause of freedom and democracy in the region. We know it's fraught with hypocrisy. We know it is fraught with all kinds of errors, factual errors. We know it's fraught with the exact opposite of what is said. But this is how heads of state do it. It's done right in the open. It's not being hidden. It's right out there. And it doesn't look like it. It doesn't sound like it, but it's it. 1-888-874-4888. So the famous cause of any speech is persuasion. We are being persuaded, and he did a very good job of it. Again, sounding very logical, sounding very rational, very approachable, not a person, thinking out of his mind, not being over emotional, but everything is in check. Very cool, very calm, very collected. But nevertheless, also delivering a kind of polemic. Do you really believe that these heads of state gathered there need a lesson about what freedom and democracy are all about? That's not what the president's speech is intended for. The president's speech indirectly is affirming what people all over the world criticize America for, and that is arrogance. Do you really believe you need to educate the world about what democracy and freedom are all about? You really believe that heads of state have left their countries to come to the General Assembly meeting to take instruction about what they ought to interpret as freedom and democracy. And you raise the old canards of freedom, democracy, and free speech. Are you kidding me? But it is meant to communicate not so much to the foreign governments, but this speech is meant to address the U.S. citizens as well, Americans, to talk to an assembled body about your particular country's views of freedom and democracy is in a way a kind of, you know, as a type of bad manners. Everybody has a different version of freedom and democracy. And they're entitled to that version of freedom and democracy based on their own definitions. We may not agree. We may not like it. We may not endorse it. But they've got their views. And if you respect sovereignty, you respect those views. But time and again, this and other U.S. administrations would continue to do this thing that is so fundamentally offensive to the rest of the world, that you have some kind of a monopoly on freedom and democracy. You have some kind of monopoly on what good citizenship is, so that you can now tell people how they ought to behave, how they ought to run their country, and what your standards are. And it is your standards that matter. It is so, in a diplomatic sense, it is so offensive for any country to presume to lecture another country or other countries about what freedom and democracy are all about. You see, that too was a very, very important message conveyed in this speech. Again, done very nicely, very, very diplomatically, doesn't sound jarring or hard. But nonetheless, the president assumes and affirms his right, quote unquote, to conduct a kind of class for the rest of the nations assembled, that this is what we like, this is how we think. And therefore, these are the standards by which we expect you, the rest of the world, to abide by and to respect as we do. And if you do that, then we have a relationship. We have by no means an equal relationship. It's not about equality. Because he's standing there as an instructor to the rest of the world. This is a fatal flaw in U.S. diplomatic efforts. The position of arrogance. You do not come to the rest of the world as a recognized member of the community of nations. You come to the rest of the world as the emperor of the world. And that's irrespective of who the president is. We are in charge. We're standing here because, okay, by protocol and whatnot, we'll show up and talk to you. But we are not equals. And don't delude yourselves. I'm here to tell you what you ought to think. I'm here to tell you about our standards and what you are expected to abide by. Because our standards supersede your standards. 1-888-874-4888. I'm interested in you deconstructing this speech as we've heard so far. Because this is how it's done, folks. This is how it is done. It's in public. This is not being hidden. And you would hardly get away, come away from watching this on any television or listening to it on any radio, that this is a very symbolic speech. Very, very symbolic. So, A, we have the President of the United States appearing in a global environment, not behaving as if he understands that he is in a global environment and that he is a nation among nations. Two, we have the president using half of his speech, laying a theoretical and philosophical foundation for what we could expect will come. And that is perhaps more intensified involvement by the United States in the region. We have the President of the United States promulgating democracy and peace as the reason or the probable reason that the U.S. would intensify its efforts. And he makes the case purely on an emotional appeal. The recent events, as I said, in Libya are tragic, but the recent events in the region have been immensely tragic to all of the nations involved. So the United States, the tragedy suffered by the United States in the region is to be seen in that context. Everybody has suffered, and a whole bunch of people are suffering even more still. But of course, in this world, what's important is what's happening to me. And therefore, you ought to know if the country speaking that way is the United States or Britain or some other, quote, superpower, unquote. That's the way they see the world. This is really terrifying. But we get the clue. You can't miss the clue. You can't miss the clue. Go back. I suggest you try and find a copy of the speech. Look again for the clues. They are there. They have been laid out. And we can expect in coming weeks and months that we would have, no matter who is in the White House, we will have actions predicated on these particular sentiments which represent one thing and one thing only, and that is the permanent strategic interests of the United States in the region. And it almost never is the case that countries put at the top of their list freedom and democracy for all. It is usually a very narrow thing, a very, very narrow interests that guide the strategic objectives of any country. But we see how they make the case. And what Ed was pointing to is what the old philosophers call the noble lie. You can misrepresent things. It's not that factually these things haven't occurred. It is just that you omit the context of it. So when you omit the context of all these assassinations that have been occurring in that region, aided and abetted by the United States and other countries, when you omit the incredible amount of violence visited upon innocent people by all parties based on their own unique strategic interests, when you omit the context of the consequences of war fomented by other interests, outside interests, and even internal interests driven by outside interests, when you omit all these contexts, you can safely say and stand on moral high ground because you enjoy a certain amount of distance from it. But this is how you see a speech. When a head of state speaks, you look behind what is said. There's a huge story behind what is said. I want to thank you so much for participating today and for lending your thoughts. But it is vitally important. I always encourage people, when you are listening, listen for what is not being said. Coming up next, right after me, is Mike Fader. Of course, you can reach me at any time at leadstories, L-E-I-D, leadstories@gmail.com. And I want to thank you again for your continued support and warm welcome here at PRN.FM. Do tell a friend and widen the circle so that when we gather here at 1 o'clock, we know we have a huge family listening, and so you can continue the discussions with each other after the program. So, thank you. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage. Money drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor, or they may call you chief. But you're gonna have to serve some.